The Recap Show is an inside look for fans into the world of global soccer, women's sports, and all things gal culture.
From the inside perspective of two World Cup champions and Olympians.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
This isn't a situation. This is hell out here.
Just coming down the street, it looked like I was entering hell.
And saw the flames and the embers coming toward me. The first thing I thought was, I'm driving into hell.
This is a special edition of the LA Local for January 8th, the day that will change everything in Los Angeles. I'm Alex Silverman. More than 1,000 structures, mostly homes, have burned. We know it's a bigger number than that. We don't know a total number of people injured or dead. That will become clear in the coming days. KNX News has live coverage 24 hours a day, 97.1 FM, 1070 AM, smart speakers, Odyssey app, everywhere you can get us. We have reporters all over the area covering these fires, and I want to start by letting you hear one of the moments where it became clear to all of us just how bad this was. My colleague Pete Demetrio calling us in the newsroom and saying, you need to put me on the air. It is a tactical situation. It is urgent that I get this message onto the air.
This isn't a situation. This is hell out here. You've got roughly, I'd say, 50 homes on Pacific Coast Highway between the 18,000 block and the 19,900 block that have gone up in flames. These are homes on the beach.
We're going to start on the scene of the fire that is now the most destructive in L.A. city history already, the Palisades Fire. John Baird has been out covering it since the very, very early hours of the morning. And, John, how do you even begin to describe the scope of what you saw today?
I'll tell you what. When I first got onto Pacific Coast Highway and saw the flames and the embers coming toward me, the first thing I thought was, I'm driving into hell. I mean, really. It was incredible. The wind was blasting through. Firefighters were trying to save homes, Firefighters were trying to save homes because the one next door would be burning. Firefighters were in a defensive mode. They were doing everything they could to save as many homes as possible, but there were so many of them on fire. It was incredible. This went on. This fight went on all night long.
And seeing some of these pictures and hearing your descriptions, we have entire neighborhoods that are wiped out. We have blocks that there are only a couple of houses standing, if any. Imagine even going back to one of those homes if you're one of the lucky ones. It's a horrible thought.
Oh, I know. And you know, there aren't that many. I mean, I was on one street where I did a rough count. I drove down the street and there were like 36 homes that were completely destroyed. And maybe there were 10 that survived. I mean, it was really incredible. And as I drove around the other blocks, it was just one home after another, completely destroyed. I've never seen anything like it. I know I was talking to another photographer, a journalist, who was we were watching a building burn in Pacific Palisades later on in the day. And he said the same thing. He's never seen anything like it.
Pacific Palisades is, I mean, you don't want to say it's gone, but for all intents and purposes, what was a community is now a shell that is going to have to entirely rebuild. I saw a picture of the Gelsons that is burnt to the ground. It's just astounding.
It is astounding. I mean, you're right. It's not like every home is destroyed or every building is destroyed, but there are so many of them still on fire that they're still trying to put out. It is chaotic in Pacific Palisades, and it will take years to rebuild that town. Years. Some schools were destroyed, so many homes, there were power lines down. But again, this was going on all day long. Even when we thought things had calmed down, I drove into Pacific Palisades, and it really was a chaotic scene.
What are you hearing from the firefighters out there that you've talked to?
Well, one of the things I was hearing this morning is they were having problems accessing water from some of the hydrants. Some of them were dry. Some of them had low pressure. I know that's been a pretty big issue, but I had one firefighter tell me, yeah, they lost a number of homes and they didn't get water. But on the other hand, I did see other firefighters who were able to access the hydrants, access water. And so I know that's something they're going to have to work on, but I think it was a little bit frustrating because they had so many homes on fire and they wanted to put them out, didn't always have water.
Yeah, extreme pressure on the system, particularly in a hilly area. You're going to hear more in a little bit on the podcast about what the city's saying about that, but it is going to be going to have to be something that has to be answered for going forward.
And we saw that in Camarillo. Same thing happened. Same thing happened. And it was such a destructive fire there. But this one, again, I'm just kind of in shock of what I have seen, the damage, the destruction of this fire that just exploded so quickly that people barely made it out.
I think a lot of people are in shock. I think all we can do today is sort of sit here in shock and think about what this means and what our future is going to look like, because everything we do now as a city and as a region is going to have to take into account what happened over the past 24 hours.
And what do they do? I mean, I was thinking about it this morning. Do we build concrete houses now? I mean, this has gotten to be such a problem, not just in Southern California, but in the state overall. So many fires, so many fire-prone areas, so many homes destroyed. It's become a complete nightmare, and somebody's going to have to find a solution.
And quickly, John, you got a look at Palisades High School, which was one of the focuses of a lot of the discussion last night about where the fire was. What did you see when you saw the aftermath of what had happened?
I thought the high school looked pretty good. I mean, basically, the brick and mortar buildings were pretty much intact. It was in the back of the school that there was extensive damage. I talked to the superintendent about that, and he said it was 25 to 30% damage, and they're going to have to figure that out. But the bigger problem is they lost two elementary schools. He says they're virtually destroyed, and they're going to have to find somewhere else, somewhere where they can send the students to school for the rest of the year. He says it's going to take a long time for them to rebuild the schools, and they're going to have to find a place for them to go for the rest of this school year and beyond.
If nothing else, and for our own sanity, we can end this on a relatively positive note. The Getty Villa Museum says its collections are preserved, its building is okay. In the grand scheme of things, not the most important, but it is something.
It is something. And, you know, I talked to a man this morning who was so fortunate. He put sprinklers on the top of his house. His house was saved. And there are a lot of stories out there like this, you know, in the middle of all this chaos and destruction, there are nuggets of some really positive stories of survival, of people making it through this. And I mean, and that's great to hear after what everyone went through over the past couple of days. It's been horrendous.
You know, that reminds me of a story of when I covered Hurricane Sandy in New York, and I was in Staten Island, and I came upon a woman who was sitting there crying. And I started to interview her, and she started to tell me about how FEMA had just denied whatever call or would not answer her call. And she was upset about that. And she said, "But that's not why I'm crying. I'm crying because all my neighbors have come over to help me today, and I'm crying for the goodness of people." And those are the kind of stories that also come out of this.
I know, and we hear a lot of them. Sometimes we hear them on an aside when we're out, but I think everyone pulls together in a situation like this. I really believe this. I think when the fire is raging and people need help, their neighbors will help. I think we've seen that in so many fires. They do what they can, but it still ends up, you know, in some ways, a tragedy. So many people losing their homes. And let's just hope that it doesn't go much farther than that.
John, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Alex.
It is not hard to destroy a college.
Last season, the podcast Campus Files brought you stories of fraternity drug rings, stolen body parts, campus cults, and more.
And now Campus Files is back for another season.
There's a guy screaming into his phone. He's like, "I just saw Charlie Kirk get assassinated right in front of me."
Every week is a new episode and a new story.
It was so chaotic.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Emily Valdez has been out covering the Eaton fire. And Emily, I heard in your voice at some point today, the weight of all of it kind of hit you. You made some reference to, you know, comparing it to what you've seen over the past 25 years.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like this. I've seen a lot of fires in my career. Most of the time, though, they are in more rural areas and they may come through and decimate some towns. But the extent of it just being in a residential area like this, I have not seen, and so widespread. I mean, I've gone from one end of Altadena to the other, and the whole top part of it, you know, it's really hit or miss, but most of the homes I saw were gone.
And when you talk to people who either stayed or are coming back to find what has been left of their homes, how can you characterize, how could you even describe the types of feelings you're getting?
Well, there's a woman standing in front of her home right now. She's been standing out here for about an hour. Both homes on either side are in active flames. Firefighters are desperately trying to save her home. I tried to talk to her, but she didn't want to talk. She's just in tears. She's devastated. I mean, this is devastating, life-changing for so many people. And what's, I think, particularly unique about and tragic is you would never picture Altadena as one of the communities that this could happen to, and so far down. You think of, okay, you know, Lake Arrowhead. Yeah. Other places that have, it's just too suburban. It's just too residential.
Yeah, we talked about this on the air. And we talked about it on the air this morning where, you know, people don't really conceive of their area as being in a fire. We know on some level that all of Southern California is a fire zone, but you don't think of your home in the middle of a densely packed neighborhood in the urban areas as being this vulnerable.
Right. That's what's shocking to me. You know, typically it'll be, you know, a mountain community or a community that's in a field. But yeah, it's right in the middle of everything. And that's what's jaw dropping about it. What else is jaw dropping is how many people did not escape and that, you know, were evacuated. And that may be part of it, too, is because you wouldn't think that the fire would come down here. But, you know, here it is. And it is absolutely devastating.
You know, there was a contrast between what you were describing in Altadena this morning of these people who were using garden hoses on their fires and people who did not evacuate, and what I was seeing on the southeastern flank of the Palisades fire when I was in Brentwood, which was a deserted neighborhood. If people were in their homes, they were not coming out to let anybody know they were there. I got the sense that everybody had heeded the evacuation order, which, you know, made me happy that, you know, they had, you know, chosen to listen. But it really stuck out to me that there was that contrast between what you were describing, what I was seeing on the west side of L.A.
And I think here's my hypothesis on that. They had the Palisades fire, which they just, you know, that's the fire that is threatening Brentwood, too. They just destroyed 1,000 homes and they just watched what it did. Whereas over here in Altadena, they hadn't seen what the Eaton fire could do yet. And people stayed, and you know, I think some people wish they hadn't.
The eyes of the world are on Los Angeles right now, and people are trying to understand, yeah, you know, how we live here and how this could happen. What do you think we'll take from this? This feels to me like a day that will change everything.
We need to be better prepared. I mean, we don't have enough fire resources. The firefighters are absolutely overwhelmed. I, you know Pasadena firefighter. He's been working over 24 hours, finally just getting down to eat. He hasn't eaten. There are no law enforcement. I know, they're strapped, but you know, there's nobody blocking off streets and roads here. As I typically see, we don't have enough personnel to fight all these fires that's happening at once. And it's kind of chaotic up here. I mean, I think there's TikTokers driving around in these neighborhoods, and it's It's frustrating to see this, all these people just kind of a free for all. I'm really glad they're calling in the National Guard. I think that needs to happen. I think there needs to be. Here's people here. They're driving down the street and it's all blocked off and then they got to turn around. And,
you know, you talk about the resources.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
I kind of couched my words last night when I was talking about it on the radio because I didn't want to contribute to panic. But I was sitting there listening to the scanner for hours at a time, and I was hearing essentially as frantic as, and dispatchers don't get frantic, but you can tell when they are really desperate to find somebody to send to a call. They're getting a call for somebody who needs advanced life support, somebody with a head injury, somebody who's trapped in their home. And they are trying to find a crew to get there, and they cannot find one. That is a situation that I think most people don't expect to have happen in the second largest city in America.
Right. I'm not afraid to say it because I've seen so many fires and seen, and this right here is a mess. They need more people out here. They don't have the people to put out here. You know, law enforcement, there needs to be more people directing traffic. Where are they? They're at the Palisades Fire. They're busy. They're going from call to call, too. There's not enough. Firefighters went to the Palisades Fire. This happened here. And you know, there's just not enough. Not enough resources. I don't know if they could fly out here or not because it is so hazy. The winds have died down, but I know Cal Fire did get a bunch of new, air fighting, equipment. I think it was from Edison, actually. It was funded through Edison, but we need more. We need more.
And at the height of it, air support couldn't operate because of the winds. And that's that, that was another thing.
Right.
That really...
And here's the thing, too. We talked about the water supply, people running out of water, and I heard somebody blaming it on the city. Yeah. Well, it also happened in Camarillo, and it also happened here in Altadena. So I think it's a problem of it seems to be a system-wide problem because I saw it in the Camarillo, in the Campos fire in Camarillo, too. And I've seen it in other fires as well in San Diego. So this isn't a unique thing.
Yep.
That everybody's turning on the faucet and there's not enough water.
Particularly in the hills when you have to rely on the pressure. I think one thing that's being lost in that conversation is that it's not necessarily a supply problem. It's a pressure and delivery problem. And when you have huge demand on the system, plus you have all these houses that are burning down and the pipes are melting and many of them are spewing water, then that puts even more pressure on the system. So that's one thing I think people need to think about in that conversation that's kind of been lost in what has already, unfortunately, become a political finger-pointing game.
Right. And that it's not the time for that right now. I don't feel it's the time for that. I just feel so many people are going through so much. And I really feel for them, and I'm really, really concerned that when this is all said and done, that we are going to find, hopefully we don't find any more people that didn't make it out. I imagine there's pets that didn't make it out, animals. I feel the toll will be higher, and it saddens me.
We can say hopefully, and we can be hopeful, but I think a lot of us know what the reality is going to end up being. Emily, thank you so much for all your coverage and for your expertise and your ability to communicate to people who desperately need it right now what's happening in their neighborhood.
Thank you, Alex.
The only way, if you have no power, if you need information 24/7 to get it, is to listen to 97.1 FM, to ask your smart speaker to play KNX News, Odyssey app, search for KNX News. We have 24/7 continuous coverage of the wildfire disaster in Southern California. Please be safe. Please let us know if you see something. Feedback at knxnews.com. Call 844-KNX-NEWS, and we will get that information out for you. Thank you for listening. Again, be safe. Take care. I'm Alex Silverman. We're sponsored by the LA Car Guy family of dealerships. See the inventory for all 12 dealerships at lacarguy.com.
Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from PUC examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.